So how did the militaristic Zen justify Japanese army activity? The interesting thing is that they did it in two different, ultimately even inconsistent ways. Sorry. First, there was, of course, the standard teleological narrative, which we find also with us in the West. It was, although in principle Buddha prohibited the taking of life, nonetheless, in order to prevent a greater harm, it's permitted to do a smaller harm, crime. So that was then their attitude towards China, that China is one big catastrophe and they have to do the smaller harm, occupy China, in order to prevent a larger danger, a larger chaos. So, against this background, they developed the notion of compassionate war. A true warrior kills out of love, like the parents, this was the usual metaphor, who strike their children out of love, to educate them, to make them happy. In this war, the sword that kills is the sword that gives life. But what I find more interesting is that above this teleological justification, war is a necessary evil performed in order to bring about the greater good, that this justification was accompanied by a more radical line of reasoning in which more directly Zen and the sword were proclaimed one and the same. This reasoning was based on the opposition between the reflexive attitude of our ordinary daily lives, we cling to life, we fear death, we strive for egotistic pleasures and profits, we hesitate instead of directly acting. So this attitude of our daily lives and the enlightened stance, Satori, in which the difference between life and death no longer matters, in which we regain the original selfless unity. We are directly our act. We no longer have the separated subjectivity. We overcome ourselves. Now, in a unique short circuit, the militaristic Zen teachers interpret the basic Zen message, the liberation resides in losing oneself, in immediately uniting with the primordial void, as identical to the utter military fidelity, to immediately following orders and performing one's duty without consideration for the self and its interest. The standard anti-militaristic cliché about soldiers being drilled to attain the state of mindless subordination and to act out, to perform orders as blind puppets, is here asserted as identical to the Zen Enlightenment. That's the basic idea, that as a perfect military machine, you overcome yourself, you are at the same time in the state of Satori. Here is the quote from one of these theorists, Ishihara Shumio. Quote, Zen is very particular about the need not to stop one's mind. As soon as flint stone is struck, a spark bursts forth. There is not even the most momentary lapse of time between these two events. If ordered to face right, one simply faces right as quickly as a flash of lightning. If one's name were called, one should simply answer yes and not stop to consider the reason why one's name was called. I believe that if one is called upon to die, one should not be agitated. Within this, end of quote, within this attitude, the warrior no longer acts as a person, but is truly, truly desubjectivized. I quote here Suzuki himself, quote, it is really not he, the soldier, but the sword itself that does the killing. The soldier had no desire to do harm to anybody, but the enemy appears and makes himself a victim. It is as though the sword performs automatically its function of justice, which is the function of mercy. So you see how here precisely this much celebrated detachment, stepping out of this immersion into life, throws this strange light on the act of killing. It's you. It's not you who does the killing. You become observer of, in a way, the observer of your own acts. Sword moves, bodies encounter the sword, you are not in it. You are out. Now, let me make here clear my point. It's not that this is the truth of Zen, that let's forget about all the talk about peace and so on, peaceful attitude. No, I think that the conclusion is, in a way, even more tragic. It's that And Suzuki was honest enough to admit it when he said that basically Zen is just a meditation technique which can be combined with Nazism, with fascism, with liberalism, with communism, and so on. That Zen is just that. Even the most authentic spiritual enlightenment is basically a spiritual technique which is as such ethically neutral. And this is, in a way, very difficult to accept. I wonder if it's translated into Hebrew, if you read it, a very instructive book, which I like very much, Aldous Huxley's The Grey Eminence, which is a wonderful book about, you know, if you try to reconstruct European history by asking, it's a mythical reconstruction, of course, but nonetheless, it's a productive intellectual game, to ask, how did Hitler begin? In the sense of, where did the European history take the wrong turn, which ultimately created the condition for the emergence of Hitler? I can give you the answer. I here follow Aldo. It's Père Joseph. Père Joseph was the counselor and confident diplomat of Cardinal Richelieu. He was the most ruthless political manipulator, feared by everyone. His true goal in the 30 Years' War was to prevent unification of Germany. And he did this by building up a totally unprincipled coalition between Catholic France and Protestant Sweden. It didn't matter this, just to prevent it. And he succeeded. And okay, if we play this intellectual game, you know, because of this German, what do you call it, Verspätung, retard in unification, conditions were created for Hitler. So again, if there is a person on whom most blame could be put, it's maybe this Père Joseph. But you know what is so shocking? At the same time, after doing his dirty work during the day, every evening he wrote mystical meditations, which I'm very sorry, but they are the real gem. They are the real thing. You cannot wash this away. They are absolutely at the level of Saint Teresa and all those big shots, how should I put it. And the problem with Huxley is that he cannot accept it. No? That he tries to find something in Judeo-Christian civilization which gives a potentially violent twist. I don't think so. I think that we should be courageous enough to accept, and that's the truly tragic task of thinking, to accept how somebody can be a horrible murderer or whatever, but at the same time, spiritually really enlightened. No, the most intense, authentic enlightenment does not prevent you to do this. Along the same lines, you know Bhagavad Gita. You know what happens there, how Krishna answers Arjuna. Quote, he who thinks it to be the killer and he who thinks it to be killed, both know nothing. The self kills not, and the self is not killed. It is not born, nor does it ever die. Weapons do not divide the self into pieces. Fire does not burn it, and so on and so on. The self is everlasting, all-pervading, stable, firm, and eternal. Now the address. Therefore, you, Arjuna the king, not to grieve for any being, having regard to your duty, your own duty also, you ought not to falter, for there is nothing better than a righteous path. Looking alike on pleasure and pain, on victory and defeat, prepare for battle, and thus you will not incur sin. End of quote. No wonder, incidentally, now I'm really evil, that, do you know that Bhagavad Gita was the favorite book of Heinrich Himmler? That he always, not to mention even that in Germany there was already in the 30s a Zen Buddhist institute, a Tibetan institute, and so on and so on. Because you know why the fascination of Germany, Nazi Germany, with Shangri-La, that with Tibet? Their idea was that we in the West are corrupted by Jews, by Semitic. And the idea was that the true Aryans not yet corrupted are there, Tibet. That's where you see. So the idea is, it doesn't really matter, even more horrifying crimes, kill. Because you don't really, you just kill reality, just appearances, and so on and so on. This is the core of this doctrine of non-involvement, of the disinterested action. Act as if it doesn't matter, as if you are not the agent. As if things, including your own acts, just happen in an impersonal way. And of course, I'm tempted here to paraphrase this passage from Bhagavad Gita as with regard to the burning of the Jews in the gas chambers. I mean, this would be the true horror of ethical heroism. Can you imagine the same scene, but instead of Arjuna, Now, this is a nasty experiment, but I think if you take ethics seriously, you should do it. Instead of Arjuna, put a Nazi or a guest chamber executor, the one who pushes the buttons or whatever. And let's say that at some moment he has doubts, no, and says, oh my God, I'm killing all these innocent Jews. And then what would then also Krishna appear and say, listen, since he who thinks it to be the killer and he who thinks it to be killed both know nothing, since the self kills not and the self is not killed, therefore you ought not to grieve for any burnt Jew, but looking alike on pleasure and pain, happily, with, of course, inner distance, push the buttons. No? So here I think we have what I am, unreconstructed Eurocentric, what I, and I will develop this more on my Wednesday's talk, as it were, on Van Leer Institute around the corner from here, what I think encompasses the difference between this Oriental compassion towards entire reality and the Judeo-Christian notion of much more intolerant, violent love. The Buddhist stance is ultimately that of indifference, or the Oriental stance, of quenching all passions which strive to establish differences. While Judeo-Christian love is a violent passion to introduce a difference, a gap in the order of being, to privilege, elevate some object at the expense of others. I think that we have to accept it. It's for me the only true love, that love is here. I'm sorry, he's a bad guy, but I'm almost tempted to do what Giorgio Agamben likes to do and to read love, at least the St. Paul Christian notion of love, through Carl Schmitt's notion of the state of emergency. Isn't love, at its most elementary level, a state of emergency? What do you mean by this? I'm here very personal and naive. Think about before and after you are in love. Before, you have your, if you are lucky enough, you have your satisfied love, you meet friends, you have maybe some love affairs, life goes on, then suddenly you fall in love. Whatever happens, don't tell me that you are happier. Love is misery. It means, you know, all your pleasures are disturbed, everything is focused on that, and love is extremely unjust. It means you, a particular contingent being, introduce a radical imbalance. You matter to me more than anything else, and so on and so on. So in a way, I think that Soviet vulgar materialist psychologist from the 20s, there was a behaviorist school there in the 20s. This you find it in a wonderful book by Eric Nyman, Sex in Public. I bought it because of the title, but then I was disappointed. It's really about the notion of sexology in Soviet. Look how the big thesis was that sexual arousal in itself is something pathological. But I think in a way they were right. That's what is sex. Of course, I turn it as an argument for sex, but that's another idea. That's to say, you know, it's just not part of this ordinary pattern. And I think this is, to put it in extremely simplistic terms, the ultimate metaphysical choice for me. Do you want this indifferent detachment, or do you accept that difference matters? Do you accept it? Of course, I'm for the second option. But now let me go to the second central part of my talk, which is how do we stand towards this difference between the surface of appearances and the inner kernel? I think that at some level we still are. Our predominant liberal ideology, at least again in its predominant version, still moves within the same horizon. How? Let me use a metaphor of an example. I don't know if you have it here, but probably it's worldwide. You also must have it here in Israel on sale. You know this popular chocolate product? I think it originated in Austria or Germany, and then now it's sold all around the world, called, at least in Europe, Kinder Surprise. You know, the empty egg shell made of chocolate, and after you unwrap and crack the chocolate egg, you find inside a small plastic toy. A child who buys this chocolate egg often nervously unwraps it and just breaks the chocolate, not bothering to eat it, worrying only about the toy in the center. When Jacques Lacan, my favorite psychoanalyst, says in his seminar 11, proposes as the formula of desire, I love you, but inexplicably, I love something in you more than yourself, and therefore I destroy you. I think this is the perfect example. A child loves chocolate, but he loves something more in chocolate. So here we have this basic tension between the official object of desire, chocolate, and what Lacan calls object small a. That is to say, the cause of desire, which is the plastic thought. Now let's do a little bit of more precise analysis here. The small plastic toy is not simply different than chocolate. It fills in the void of the chocolate itself. What do I mean by this? As we know already from Marx, commodity is a mysterious entity full of theological caprice. A particular object satisfying a particular need, but at the same time the promise of something more, of an unfathomable enjoyment whose true location is fantasy. You know, a commodity always promises something more. You buy this drink, it's not just this, it's some mysterious more. And I think this Kinder Surprise is a kind of a reflective commodity where they say, we promise more, but we will even, we will give you, we will materialize for you even this excess. The Kinder Egg thus provides the formula for all the products which promise more. You know, like buy a DVD player and get 5 DVDs for free. Or my favorite example, I love it. I don't know if you have it here, you have it all around Europe, toothpaste. When you buy a toothpaste, usually the upper third is even in different color and it says this is the 30% you get for free. Of course, my idea is to come there with scissors and to get just the free part. You cannot, unfortunately, no? But you got the point. The point is that this Kinder Surprise manipulates the elementary metaphysical structure of a commodity, that it's always a promise of more and fills in the gap, as it were, provides you with more. Now, how did this emerge? Let's go back in two steps. First to Elizabethan England. Do you know that there, with the rise of modern subjectivity, something interesting happened at the level of food, of eating? There was a difference emerged in Elizabethan England between the substantial, real food, usually meat, eaten in the great banquet hall, and the sweet things, cakes, desserts, eaten in the separate small room, while the tables were cleared, voided in the banquet hall. So the small room in which the sweets were consummated was called the void. It's very interesting that this was the principal meaning of the term void in Elizabethan England. Not this metaphysical void, but void, perfect, let's enjoy void. It means let's not mystical in rapture, but let's go to the small room near the banquet hall and so on. Consequently, the sweets, the cakes, which were consummated there, were themselves referred as voids. I mean, you know, if you look at, I saw a reproduction of it, the cooking books of late 16th century, you have a chapter on how to prepare voids, which meant what? Which meant that this, as a kind of ironic repetition, these small merchandise, cakes, themselves imitated the form of Kinder Surprise of void. It was usually a kind of a fake imitation of the real food. Like it was a pheasant, but made only out of thin crust of sugar and colored with a void, nothing inside. And here I think we have, like to apply Hegel to it, the important thing is to conceive of food not only as substance, but also as subject. No, you had substantial food, and this void was a place of subjectivity there. Because precisely it was pure caprice and so on. I think that this was maybe the early modern version of today's decaffeinated coffee or artificial sweeteners. The first example of the food deprived of its substance, so that eating it, one was in a way eating nothing. Okay, we can go on here into how this private space of the void was the first space, literally, of subjectivity also. You know, because in the public banquet hall, it was your official self, this was the private self. But something else is more interesting here. How? This reference to zero, void, related, is co-substantial also, with the explosion the production of commodities, with the expansion of commodity exchange. So, I'm tempted even, I don't have time to do it now systematically, to go a step further and claim that already at the beginning of philosophy, Old Greece, we have what object would be there. Maybe you know Heidegger's famous analysis in his short text, Das Ding, of the Greek vase as the thing as the thing. The idea being that it's a game. Now, I will say the really obscene thing. My idea is, of course, that the thing was the old Greek's Kinder chocolate, no? Because it was a vase, and Heidegger plays all the game about how it's the void inside. Void from which that it's the Greek vase is just surrounding, marking off of the void. And I think it's maybe not such a accidental fact that at the beginning of philosophy, when we have these objects, the beginning of philosophy was exactly also the beginning of money economy, exchange economy, and so on and so on. So you know how Adorno and Horkheimer in their Dialectic of Enlightenment, how they like in their paradoxic statements to condense the entire Western philosophy, as it from the primordial myths to our vulgar consumption society, there is a direct kind of a line between. And along the same line, I would say maybe one way to condense Western history would be from the Greek vase to this Kinder Surprise chocolate X. Okay, but enough of this fun, because now we should do something much more serious, which is to develop how, that's my thesis, how there is a structural homology between this Kinder Egg logic of void, filling the void, and the structure of the subject of universal human rights. Do subjects of universal human rights also not function as a kind of Kinder chocolate eggs? What do I mean by this? In France, it is still possible, I was shocked, but it is still possible to buy a cake with the racist name La Tête du Nègre, the nigger's head. It's, again, a ball-like chocolate cake, empty in its interior. Of course, probably the racist idea is like the stupid nigger's head, where there is nothing inside. And the Kinder egg precisely fills in this void. The lesson of it is that we all have, this would be my idea, we all have nigger's heads with a hole in the center. And the humanist, universalist reply to this nigger's head, La Tête du Nègre, would be precisely something like a Kinder egg. We may be indefinitely different. Some of us are black, others white, some tall, others small, some rich, others poor, some women, other men. Yet deep inside us, there is some kind of moral equivalent of the plastic toy. Or, to quote Francis Fukuyama from his last book, what the demand for equality of recognition implies is that when we strip all of a person's contingent and accidental characteristics away, there remains some essential human quality underneath that is worthy of a certain minimum of respect. Call it factor X. Skin, color, looks, social class, wealth, gender, cultural background, even one's natural talents are all accidents of birth. But in the political realm, we are required to respect people equally on the basis of their possession of factor X. End of quote. So in contrast to transcendental philosophers who emphasize that this factor X is a kind of symbolic fiction with no counterpart in the reality of an individual, Fukuyama, I almost admire him for this, heroically locates it into our human nature, into our unique genetic inheritance. And maybe Genome is the ultimate figure of the plastic toy hidden deep within our human chocolate skin. So it can be a white chocolate, a standard milk chocolate, a dark chocolate with nuts, without nuts, with raisins. Inside it, there is always the same plastic toy. In contrast to the Kinder eggs, which are the same on the outside, while each has a different toy hidden inside. But we can also exploit the example of Kinder eggs in this way. We could focus on the fact that the chocolate cover is always the same, while the toy in the middle is always different.